You know, what we learn from the book of Acts about Paul's quick visit, relatively quick visit, to Thessalonica is fairly minimal, you know, 9 verses. But Thessalonica was a major city, okay? And the history of it and the dynamics of that area play a big role in our understanding of the two epistles that Paul wrote to this church. And the reason I say that is because, and I think you'll appreciate it when we get finished with what we're going to talk about tonight, you'll see that many of the issues that are touched upon in the Thessalonian epistles, and you know they're both short. You know, 1 Thessalonians is only 5 chapters. That there are little points in the epistle that relate to the big picture of this particular area. So I've got to do a juggling act up here, since I'm not going to try. See if I can. Thessalonica was in Macedonia, and obviously these are Latin renderings of what we would recognize as English terms, for the most part. The dark red right here is the largest collection of the various little regions that eventually was Macedonia. The big picture here is what? The Roman Empire, isn't it? Yeah, the Roman Empire. And, of course, we recognize this as Italy. This we recognize as Greece. This would be the Aegean Sea. And, of course, this is the Adriatic Sea over here. Let's see. Maybe if I use this. Oops. Okay. I'll try this. This is a little bigger, you know, rendering of this particular region. Thessalonica is right there. Right. Now, Athens is down here. Corinth is right there. And so, over here on the other side of the Aegean Sea, you've got Troas, Assos, Ephesus would be right in here. But Thessalonica was at a key crossroads. It had a magnificent harbor. If you can tell how the blue kind of goes up into here, and then at this harbor area, this kind of this bay, and then when you get into Thessalonica itself, it's an absolutely perfect harbor. It was founded, that is, Thessalonica itself was founded in 325 B.C. by the emperor or king of Macedonia by the name of Cassandra. He named it after his wife, Thessalonica. Right? How original. She was the half-brother of Alexander the Great. So you had some political connections there with Thessalonica, that is, the wife of Cassandra. If you read a history of this area, you know that there was a lot of fussing and fighting going on for a long time. We covered a lot of these wars in our study of the fulfilled prophecy when we were doing intertestamental period. You might recall we talked about that because the book of Malachi ends at about, roughly, round numbers, when? This is a test. You didn't know you were going to have a test tonight. When does the Old Testament, round numbers, when does it end?
400 B.C.
All right, 400 B.C. And Alexander the Great did his little escapade in what? Early or late? Pretty late, because we're counting backwards, right? Late 300s, right? So we're looking at 100 plus years when Alexander the Great enters the picture. We're looking, and by the way, you know, Philippi is named after his father, Philip of Macedon. Okay, and so the Greeks were fussing and fighting over all this territory. The Romans enter the picture a little later on, and of course they're gaining control. And I think the decisive battle was at in the area of Philippi or somewhere in this region, and I've forgotten. It's not not something that I can remember very well. I know we went over that. But in 167, in 167 B.C., the Romans divided the area of Macedonia into four separate regions, and they picked Thessalonica as the capital of the second district. And then in 146 B.C., it became the seat of the provincial administration for this whole area. Now, it was a free city, like Antioch of Syria, Tarsus, and Athens, rather than being a colonized city like Philippi was, Troas, and Antioch and Pisidia. So it had the right of self-government, as long as they didn't make a fuss or, you know, cross Rome. They had the right of self-government in Thessalonica or in this region. Now, that's gonna be significant whenever we take note of some things that happened there. as far as the religion of this area, you've got, of course, the Greek influence of the Greek gods, but then, of course, the Romans are the, you know, they're the new kid on the block, and so the Romans have brought their system into the region. And what's ironic is that the people who we would say, you know, they don't have to be the geniuses, but the people that had some smarts, they had already figured out that if a god was really a god, then he wasn't regional and he wasn't racial. That was the ancient pagan way of thinking that, well, you know, I've got my god, and they had a god for almost every city, and they thought that, you know, he was their god, and they were going to he was going to take care of them. But these people have begun to figure out that, you know, that just doesn't make any sense. So they were not as closely tied to the religiosity of the pagan system as their ancestors had been. However, the Romans wanted to make sure that the people felt a real close tie to Rome, and so they were kind of forcing that system upon this region. Particularly attractive to many people was all of the nonsense and the just utter debauchery that went with this Roman system. Of course, many of the pagan rites were extremely, extremely coarse and sensual, which led to immorality. You might remember from our study of Corinth how, you know, there were a thousand temple prostitutes who came down on the streets of Corinth every night to ply their trade upon the citizens of that city. And the same was true in Ephesus, Antioch of Pisidia. There was prostitution associated with their religion. So it was kind of an excuse for, that is, to say it was religion. Well, that just was nothing more than just an excuse to engage in all of these activities. Let me get this out of the way. Same juggling act here. So, as a result, the Greco-Roman world of the first century was just reeked with vice, just utterly rotten, except that there were certain elements of people that
were repulsed by it. And so, you know, we had some people that were attracted to the idea of a higher standard of morality. But there was this group, we call them the dregs of society, but in the text it's called the rabble. They exercised no moral restraint whatsoever. And upper society was saturated with corruption, indulgences of every kind, and divorce was rampant. In fact, in many cases, the archaeologists who have dug into the ancient civilization of this era, this time, have found that the most prevalent documents in antiquity were divorce documents. And so the family was, for the most part, something of, I guess, something of an ideal, but not a reality. Also, they weren't too keen on working. Idleness was rampant. One of the reasons is because there was a lot of slave labor. Well, if you could get the slaves to work for you, then you didn't have to do anything. You could just sit around, twiddle your thumbs, or you could do like the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers in Athens, and that is you could just try to think of something new. Or if some guy comes along and he's preaching or teaching something new, then you can entertain him, and you can sit around and muse about that for a long time. And so, you know, there was really no premium placed on honest labor and toil. And we're going to see that come out in our study of the epistle. In fact, idleness was kind of a badge of the aristocracy. You know, if you didn't have to work, then that means you were something. Okay? Or if you could figure out some way to make it look like you didn't need to work. So this was a problem. Also, the idea of dying in the grave was just abhorrent to many of them. You know, Sunday night we dealt with that subject about the fear of death. And so when one would come along and preach about one who had abolished death and brought life and immortality to light through the gospel, well, this was like, what? That's not what I understood about death. You know, so that was kind of shocking to them. There was a Jewish synagogue in Thessalonica. And like Philippi, remember that Paul and Silas had been in Philippi along with a couple of their traveling companions, it looks like, and at least one or two. And in Philippi, there was no synagogue. They did find some Jewish ladies worshiping. Remember one of them? Lydia. But they were out by the riverside, weren't they? Under the trees, out by the riverside. So when they got to Thessalonica, there in fact was a synagogue there, which means that there was a fairly decent contingent of Jews in Thessalonica. Now, we might ask ourselves, well, why was Thessalonica such a hopping place? Well, that's a good question. Okay, so we'll see what we can figure out here. Oops. The Via Ignatia, the Ignatian Way. It starts right here. I guess you pronounce that Drachium or something like that. Heads across Lower Balkans here. This now would be what? Albania, Macedonia, into Greece. Right there in Thessalonica. And you see where it goes? It goes to Amphipolis, Philippi, through this region right here, to Byzantium.
There, this place has a different name now. I wonder, do you know what city is right there? Yes. Istanbul, which was previously Constantinople. Right. Istanbul, right on the Bosphorus, which is the waterway, the between Asia and Europe. Right. So this is a major city. I mean, major roadway.
It okay. Let's see if I can get over here. I know what I need to do. Get that out of the way. You should be read that. I just want to, this is a very significant thoroughfare. Okay, it was constructed by the Romans around the 2nd century B.C. And again, it crosses the Roman provinces of Illyricum and Macedonia. Illyricum, that, you know, Paul talks about that. Macedonia, Thrace. One of the cities that goes through is Neapolis. Now, this is Neapolis right here, right on the shores of the Aegean Sea. That's just about 8 or 10 miles south of Philippi. Philippi wasn't on the ocean. This was the seaport for Philippi. But you can see it's a kind of a hilly area that comes down, and the city was right up against the ocean. This road was about 696 miles long. Okay, almost 700 miles. The Romans were masterful road builders. Okay. Does anybody know about how many miles of roads the Romans built? 50,000 miles of roads. And they weren't just little footpaths. Okay. Let me go back over here. What happened here? Okay. Let's go here. I was not supposed to dump that. I want to back over here. This road... You might notice that this road goes from over here on the Balkan Peninsula back over here. This is the bottom of the boot of Italy. And now that road right there is the Appian Way. And you know where all roads led? Roma. Right. All roads led to Rome. Now, it was not just a matter of convenience of, well, how do we get to Rome and back? The roads served a critical service for the movement of military personnel and supplies. So as the Romans expanded their territories, they wanted to be able to get their troops into the hotspot quickly and also to be able to maintain supply lines to them. And so that was one of the major reasons, not the only, but, you know, because commerce was certainly a big factor, but that was one of the major reasons for the roads that they built. And as I said, they weren't just wagon trails. They built a road. Okay, they dug out some dirt and they made a road bed. They put larger stones typically in the bottom of it, then crushed stones on top of that, and then some compacted sand, and then a layer of paving stones on top of that. And you notice that this is kind of
crowned. So the water would run off. And what didn't run off, it would percolate down through here. This is kind of like a French drain. And then it also had gutters on the sides. These are called KERB, curb stones. And so, and then oftentimes they would have walkways beside the road.
Now the Ignatian Way was about 20 feet wide. Instead of 700 miles long. Now that was a major road project. Okay. Gotta remember these were built by hand. But they could move a lot of personnel and a lot of material over that road rather quickly. This was the road that Paul traveled whenever he came from Philippi to Thessalonica. I wonder about how many miles a day a person could cover on a road like this, walking. Easily 30 miles a day. Okay, 30 miles a day. So it would probably take him about 3 days. It was about 100 miles from Philippi to Thessalonica. And of course, he had a lot of practice walking. Okay, so if he walked a little faster and maybe a little longer, he might be able to go more than 30 miles. But that was kind of a rule of the thumb, about 30 miles a day that these people walked. All right, there, and I don't know exactly where this is, but this is typical of what you'll find today in a lot of places where the Romans built roads. Now, obviously, they haven't been well maintained in a lot of cases. Sometimes, you know, you just find a few paving stones here and there. But that road's about 2,000 years old. Okay, we've got roads around here that are, you know, probably less than 20 years old that have potholes in them, and you can't hardly drive down them. And they have been patched umpteen times. So, you know, they built those roads to stay, and so they were very effective. All right, Thessalonica, obviously today, but you know, remember I said what a beautiful, perfect harbor Thessalonica was, and it does. See, the city surrounds this this cove, right? And then you can tell this kind of slopes up. This is taken from up on one of those hills, a medieval tower and wall, but looking back out toward the ocean, you can see how it kind of curves around. This is just around the corner. The city's over here. This is just around the corner, the beautiful blue Mediterranean. So, it was a gorgeous, gorgeous area. It attracted a lot of people for commerce, a nice place to live. A lot of sea traffic. Okay, it was the major port in that region. So all of the if you think back north, going up towards Macedonia, the Balkans, and up in that direction, all of the produce that came out of that region was being shipped somewhere. It came through Thessalonica, kind of like the port of Los Angeles. I mean, it was the major port in that whole region. So you had a lot of comings and goings and all kinds of activities in this region. So I think we can understand and appreciate to some extent why Paul was eager to get to Thessalonica. Now, when he left Philippi, it wasn't exactly on the best of terms with the locals. In fact, he was told to get out of Dodge, wasn't he? He had been in prison, and the miraculous event that occasioned his release from prison. But still, they were kind of anxious to get him out of town, as the local authorities were. So the text tells us that he headed for Thessalonica.
Let's look at the text now in Acts the 17th chapter. Let's see. I think I had that up here. Let's see if I can get back over there. That would be right there. Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica. Now Amphipolis and Apollonia were good-sized cities along the road. They were on the Ignatian Way. It's entirely possible that he stopped there. It's hard for me to believe that Paul would pass through any place without preaching the gospel, but we don't know what he did. The text does not tell us. We have absolutely no information about any of the preaching that he might have done in any place along the way. So we're left in the dark there. But we do know that he came to Thessalonica. And that, as his custom was, well, wait a minute. Let's go back and identify who we're talking about. When they came to Thessalonica, they came to Thessalonica. Who is they? You remember? We know who one of them was, don't we? He was in jail with Paul. All right. And Timothy. There is another person alluded to in Acts the 16th chapter. In fact, in verses 11 through 16, the personal pronoun we is used 1, 2, 3, 4, and us, 5, 6. 6 times in 6 verses. That would be Luke. Yes. Remember, Luke wrote Acts. So when you see we did this, we did that, Luke is in the traveling entourage. When he says they, then Luke's not with them. So it appears that Luke stayed in Philippi. And that whenever Paul went back through that region on his way to Jerusalem, back to 19th, 20th chapter, back into there, sometime or another, Luke must have rejoined him. But as far as right now, Luke is out of the picture. So we've got Paul and Silas and Timothy. All right. So as verse 2 again, as his custom was, he went into them, that is to the synagogue, for 3 Sabbaths, reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and demonstrating that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, saying, "This Jesus, whom I preach to you, is the Christ." And some of them were persuaded, and a great multitude of the devout Greeks and not a few of the leading women joined Paul and Silas. So Paul immediately preaches Christ from the scriptures because he's preaching to Jews who are acquainted with the scriptures, and they're the ones that are anticipating the Messiah, the Christ. We talked about that for a few months prior to Cameron taking the class, the fulfilled prophecies. So this is what ostensibly they were looking for, was the fulfillment of that prophecy. However, the prophecy of the Christ. However, it doesn't appear that very many of them were persuaded by what Paul had to say. That is, very many of the Jews. A few were. Quite a few of the Greeks, and this not a few, which is, that's kind of a backwards way of saying a good number of the leading women joined Paul and Silas. But the Jews were not persuaded. That is, the majority of the hard-nosed Jews were not persuaded by what Paul said. Now, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. Get down to it in the book of Acts, but you might recall something that was said about the Jews in Thessalonica in comparison to the next town that Paul went to. Remember where the next town was that Paul went to after Thessalonica? Berea. What is said about the Bereans in comparison to the Jews in Thessalonica?
All right. They were more noble than those in Thessalonica because they searched the scriptures daily to see whether these things were so. Now, the clear implication of that statement is that the Jews in Thessalonica didn't search the scriptures to see whether what Paul was saying was true or not. They jumped to the conclusion, and who knows why, we could probably think of several reasons. Well, in fact, when we get into the study of the epistle itself, we're going to see what they were saying about Paul. But they had already made up their mind that they didn't like what Paul was saying. They didn't like Paul. They thought he was a mercenary. And so therefore, they just closed their mind. They didn't consider that what Paul was saying lined up with what the scripture said about the coming of the Christ. So that's the big, huge difference between those in Berea and those in Thessalonica. Yes, sir?
Would the necessary inference be that they have copies of the Septuagint then there at Berea?
The synagogues, they had the Old Testament scriptures now. And I think the necessary conclusion would be that it was probably the Septuagint, yes. But that's what they did in the synagogues. They got the scrolls out and they read them. And so they had the text. Now, if those in Thessalonica were doing what everybody else did in the synagogue, they read the scriptures. But just because they read them didn't mean that they put two and two together. Especially not if they had their mind made up, number one, about what the Christ was going to be, and number two, the presupposition that they, or the assumption that they made about Paul's motives and his techniques. It's interesting that there were apparently a fair number of quote-unquote preachers / philosophers / you name it that roamed the territory just looking for an audience, and if anybody would sit still for very long, they would start their spiel. Basically, that's what happened in Athens, wasn't it? Because whenever Paul went to Athens and they found out what Paul was preaching, which they hadn't heard before, well, you know, the Epicurean Stoic philosophers invited him up there to Mars Hill and said, you know, because they just wanted to hear something new. They didn't really care about the truth. They just wanted to hear something new. So from what I read about this period of time in this region, there were a lot of guys just going around, and they were mercenaries. You know, if they could, I don't know if they put their hat on the ground and waited for, you know, somebody to throw a few bucks in it or what they did, or a few drachma or, you know, whatever they did. But anyway, that was kind of the par for the course. And so these people had assumed that that's what Paul was. Well, again, that's the implication of what we read in, and I'm getting ahead of where we're going to be when we study in 1 Thessalonians, but that's certainly the charge that was made against Paul. Why they were more disposed to do that than the ones in Berea, I don't know. Unless it was just, you know, the obvious answer is their heart, the difference in the hearts. The people in Berea obviously were sincere, and they really did want to know whether or not what they were hearing from Paul was true or not, and there was one way to check that out, and that was to look at the scriptures. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And Peter did.
So the comments about Berea and Thessalonica are about the Jews, where it says they were more noble-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He's talking about the Jews there.
Right. Yeah. Because they examined the scriptures daily, whether these things were so, and the Jews were the ones that would have access to the scriptures in the synagogue. You see, it's talking about Acts 17. In Acts 17, verse 10, when they were come thither, went into the synagogue of the Jews. Now these, the antecedent of these is the Jews. Right. And then, of course, then verse 13 of Acts chapter 17, when the Jews of Thessalonica had knowledge that the word of God had been proclaimed at Paul of Berea, also they came thither likewise, stirring up and troubling the multitude. So they were dead set on causing Paul all kinds of grief, which they managed to do to some extent. We'll talk a little bit more about that, considerably more about it, whenever we get into the text in 1 Thessalonians. Now, let's go on down to the rest of this text. Oh, the leading women. There's, and also the great multitude of devout Greeks. I want to say something about that. Some commentators think that the devout Greeks there were either proselytes or pseudo-proselytes. They were attracted to Judaism, at least the morality of Judaism, and maybe they were kind of hanging around the synagogue. Some say they were actually proselytes. The fact is, we don't know. We don't know. You know, there was another notable Roman earlier in the book of Acts that was also a devout man that wasn't a Christian. Cornelius, Acts chapter 10. He was devout. And of course, we know he obeyed the gospel. So, I don't know. Other than that, the word devout just means that these are really sincere people. And then leading women, they could be wives of prominent citizens. Josephus alludes to, and then there are other historical references to the possibility that, in fact, in Macedonia, there were women who occupied positions of authority in the sense of local. You know, they weren't just like many of the other areas where the woman absolutely had no place at all, but in Macedonia, it seems like that they did have some positions. Well, you know, perhaps that's why Lydia was in Philip. We know she was in a seller of purple. That was her business. And maybe it was more conducive for women to be businesswomen slash, you know, I'll use that term very, very loosely and accommodatively, and to function in Macedonia than other parts of the world. So these leading women, again, I, other than what the text says, I don't know specifically in what sense they were leading, whether it was their husbands or whether they had some prominent positions. Okay. Well, the Jews are all, you know, they're all in a dither. They are really hopping mad at what Paul has done, and so they were not the least bit persuaded by what he had said. And so the text says, verse 5, they became envious and took some of the evil men, or my version says the rabble, evil men from the marketplace, and gathering a mob, set all the city in an uproar and attacked the house of Jason. Well, they thought Jason was obviously hiding Paul, and probably Silas and Timothy, and sought to bring them out to the people. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some of the brethren to the rulers of the city, crying out, "These who have turned the world upside down have come here too." The brethren, some brethren, these could be converts, it could be some of their Jewish brethren, and or it could be some of the Jewish brethren that were converted. Whatever. The charge was that Paul and Silas had turned the world, you know, they were turning the world upside down, and Jason has harbored them. That is, he's been keeping them and hiding them. And these are all acting contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there's another King Jesus. Now, one of the things we know that Paul preached is, when he preached Christ, he preached the position of Christ as the King. Now, it's obviously a perversion of what he preached to say that Paul was setting forth Christ as a alternative to Caesar. That would have been treason, and that would have been a charge for which Paul would have been in a lot of trouble, but that isn't what he was preaching. But that's the charge they made against Paul in order to try to get Paul in as much trouble as possible so that they could get him, hopefully, to hush and probably locked up and maybe even shipped off to Rome as a traitor. So, again, these Jews, they trouble the crowd and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. And so when they had taken security from Jason and the rest, they let them go. And then the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. So, exactly what Jason pledged to do on their behalf, again, we're not told. So some have likened this to, well, he just posted bail for them. That doesn't seem to be consistent with what we know about their system, their legal system. More likely, he just maybe said, you know, we'll get Paul out of town. I don't know. But the fact is, they did get him out of town. They got Paul and Silas out of town, which left Timothy there. But they got Paul and Silas out of town. And we're going to see, we're going to bump into Timothy and a little bit later on, and Paul and Silas too. But anyway, that's when they headed for Berea. So, again, then the big question comes up, one question that often comes up is, well, so how long was Paul in Thessalonica? Well, we know for sure he was there for 3 weeks. At least 3 Sabbath days. Some have suggested that he might have been there a little bit longer. Perhaps he was in the synagogue for 3 weeks and maybe he was around in the city a little longer. I don't know. And the reason that they say that is because in Philippians, I believe it's Philippians chapter 4, Paul said of those that were in Thessalonica that they sent once and again unto my need. I mean, excuse me, the Philippi, the Philippians sent to Paul support whenever he was in Thessalonica and sent once and again into my need. And some say, well, that means they sent it twice and there wouldn't have been time for all that to happen in 3 weeks. And, well, it could have. You know, if it's only 100 miles and they're hot-footing it across there, they could get across there in a couple of days or 3 days. And so it's possible that they could have gotten support to Paul twice in 3 weeks. Whatever, it was a fairly short period of time, okay, that Paul was in Thessalonica. I think we can be reasonably comfortable with that conclusion. Now, Paul went on down from Berea to where? Athens. Right. In Athens, he waited for his traveling companions to come. Then he moved on down to, what was the next city from Athens?
Corinth.
Exactly, Corinth. The best guess is that Paul wrote 1 Thessalonians from Corinth. Okay. Because he had gotten... he'd received information about what was happening in Thessalonica from Timothy and Silas. Apparently, they went back with Paul's, wrote a letter. Then they took that one back. So, and there's a lot. We don't know exactly because the text doesn't tell us, so there's some supposition here. But the bottom line is there was communication between Paul and those in Thessalonica whenever he was moving down the coast going on into Corinth. Which would mean that this was probably the first letter that Paul wrote. 1 Thessalonians. Possibly Galatians preceded it, but that's a guess. Yeah, we don't know. We don't know when this one was written, except because of the mention of Gallio in Acts chapter 18 and verse 12, being the proconsul in Achaia. His tenure in Corinth, according to Roman records, was around 50, 51, 52. And typically, those proconsuls only served in that post for about 2 years, and then they were shipped off somewhere else. So, because Gallio was the proconsul in Corinth, and he's mentioned in Acts 18:12, then the best guess is that Paul wrote 1 Thessalonians around 50-ish, one, whatever, A.D. So, that would, again, or at least suggest that this letter, 1 Thessalonians, preceded Galatians. Not that it matters, but if we're trying to kind of put these things in sequence, that's a pretty good guess. If the Holy Spirit wanted us to know any more than that, he would have told us. But what it does is, again, it puts in perspective Paul's work. Again, the communication that Paul was receiving from these churches and his response to them. And that helps us, at least it does me, it helps us kind of get the big picture in mind as we study the apostles' work. We're just about out of time. You have any comments or questions that I can look up between now and whenever we take this up again? Yeah.
One comment in verse 6 where it says that, you know, they've turned the world upside down. It's like their reputation had preceded them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes to prove, you know, at the beginning of Acts or whenever it was, when it says they were going to preach to the whole world,
mm-hmm.
it proves it right here.
Yes, Paul had made one previous journey, you know, his first journey into what we would know as Asia Minor. So obviously the information was being spread. And the second thing is that we know that what had happened in Philippi had probably, the news of what had happened in Philippi most likely had gotten to Thessalonica. That was no small stir in Philippi. So, yes, Richard.
Yeah, I'm surprised that the Jews allowed him to speak in the temple.
Well, that was a common practice. If a fellow Jew came in there, who was, again, you remember who he was? He was a Pharisee, and
like a town hall.
No, they had their own structure. It was a meeting house that the Jews constructed.
Because as much as they hated Paul, they still allowed him to see. They seemed to allow him in any temple that he went into.
Well, initially, you know, I guess.
Then they find Paul wanted to kill him.
Well, they had a problem there because they were still under Roman authority, so they had to defer to the Romans to try to get them to do their dirty work for them. What I would urge you to do between now and whenever I'm back up here is read Thessalonians every week. That's only one chapter a day. 1 Thessalonians is 5 chapters. Read it every day until we pick it up. There is absolutely no substitute for reading the text. And the more you read it, you think about what we've talked about tonight, I think you're going to begin to get a good feel for putting yourself in the shoes of these people in Thessalonica that received this letter. Thank you for your attention, and this will be continued.